Well, good morning, everyone. I will call the hybrid meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee for April the 20th to order. This hybrid hearing is taking place pursuant to Rule 10.01 and can also be viewed through the House webcast. Ms. Anna, will you please take the roll for attendance?
Chair Moran.
Present.
Vice Chair Olson.
Present.
Representative Garofalo.
Present.
Representative Albright.
Present.
Representative Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Bernardi.
Present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Hansen. Representative Hassan. Representative Hertas. Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Kreshaw.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Mariani.
Mariani present.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Miller.
Present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Noor. Representative O'Neill.
Present.
Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski present.
Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Here.
Representative Sundin.
Sundin present.
Representative Hansen.
Hansen present.
Hansen present. Representative Hassan. Representative Hertas. And Representative Noor.
Noor present.
Noor present. Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
A quorum is present. So members, we don't have minutes ready for approval today, so we'll do that tomorrow. No. Members, we also have a full agenda. If there's anyone in the audience for the education bill, they will be heard. They will not be heard today. Instead, they have been scheduled for Thursday. Since there is no session, we can meet until noon to complete this agenda if needed. All right. First up is Chair Nelson with House File 4017, which is a pension policy bill. It came to us from the State Government Finance Committee. Chair Nelson, would you like to move that House File 4017 be recommended for placement on the general register?
That's my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay, and you also have an A1 officer amendment. Would you like to move that now?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'll move the A1 amendment, and Madam Chair, that's why the bill is here. There's a study in the bill for the Department of Labor and Industry and workers' comp to deal with firefighters and police disability benefit, whether they're up to snuff and they need to be, and so this funds that. So the appropriation is $125,000 to the Department of Labor and Industry for the cost associated with doing that study.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions on the amendment? If not, the Office A1 amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So House File 4017, as amended, is before us. Chair Nelson, please continue with your presentation.
And Madam Chair and members, this bill is the policy bill coming from the Pension Commission. It includes a bunch of different bills from different people, and these all were heard in the Pension Commission. It extends the period that the military service period of time that they can buy back service in the pension when they were in military service. It adds dental hygienists to the correctional plan, there's a bunch of individual bills in there that from different, also with the Duluth Transit Authority, it allows those people to not have to be in para, but to remain in the pension plan that they're currently in. The city of Duluth is taking over the transit authority, and so now these people would be considered public employees, but we're allowing them to stay in the pension plan that they're currently in. And like I said, I'll stand for questions. It basically, it's a bunch of policy things that came, and they were all approved by the Pension Commission.
All right, thank you. So no other amendments were pre-filed. Are there any questions or comments on the bill? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, thank you for following the recommendations of the Pension Commission. I'll be supporting this bill and encourage others to do the same. Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing no further questions. Chair Nelson, any closing comments?
Madam Chair, no, as I said, this is the bill that came out of the Pension Commission. And like I said, it's the policy bill. The only money in it is for that study. And I ask for your support.
Thank you. So the Nelson motion before us is that House File 4107, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. Ms. 4017. Ms. Anna, please take the roll.
Chair Moran.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo.
Garofalo, aye.
Garofalo, aye. Representative Albright.
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Becker Finn.
Becker Finn, aye.
Becker Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi.
Bernardi, aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan. Representative Hertas. Representative Hornstein.
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Johnson, aye. Representative Grisha.
Grisha, aye.
Grisha, aye. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani.
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marcourt.
Aye.
Marcourt, aye. Representative Miller.
Aye.
Miller, aye. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Nash, aye. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor.
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill.
Aye.
O'Neill, aye. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg.
Aye.
Petersburg, aye. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott.
Aye.
Scott, aye. Representative Sundin.
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. And Representative Hassan. And Representative Hertas. Madam Chair, that is 27 ayes and no nays.
On a vote of 27 ayes and zero nays, the motion prevail, and House File 4017, as amended, is on to the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
members, and I hope I get as much support on my next bill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson.
Not so much.
Members, so the next four bills on the agenda will be merged into House File 4293 for one omnibus bill on state government, veterans and military affairs, pension and transportation to line up with the Senate for the conference committee. We will proceed as we did yesterday. We consider each bill and associated amendments and then temporarily lay over until they are merged by motion. So the first bill in this package is 1683, which is the Supplemental Transportation Omnibus Bill. Chair Hornstein. Good morning, Chair Hornstein.
Good morning, Chair Moran and members.
Would you like to move House File 1683 to get the bill before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1683 to be referred to the General Register.
Thank you. So let's hear about your bill, and then we'll take up your amendments.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. So House File 1683 is this year's supplemental omnibus transportation policy and finance bill. I'd like to thank the members of our committee who are on this committee and also Representative Petersburg as the lead. We had a target of $225 million, and then that was for the first biennium, and another $100 million of that also in the tails. And our real goal this year, Madam Chair and members, was to match the very significant historic federal infrastructure bill that was passed late last year. That's known as the Investment, Infrastructure, and Jobs Act, also known as the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And in order to access that historic federal amount of federal money, really of the most in an infrastructure bill from the federal government since the New Deal, we have to match that money in order to access it. And so $80 million of this bill is for that purpose. And I think that is the number one priority here. And we have certain specific areas that we would like, that we set some guidance and parameters on, but leave a lot of flexibility within this bill for the state to access those dollars. The second item that is of significance in this bill is money to support the NLX passenger rail line from Minneapolis to Duluth, and that is approximately $85 million. And then the remainder is for a number of different projects, primarily focused on, one of our main focuses was on safety. We have an epidemic of significant fatalities and injuries on our roads. 502 Minnesotans lost their lives, and we have a significant number of provisions related to highway and traffic safety, transit, support for townships and small cities. This is a bill that covers all parts of the state, all modes of transportation. There's also trunk highway bond funding for critical bridge supports. That's $80 million, and then $69 million for various MnDOT facilities. So that is the broad overview of the bill. I'm happy to answer questions. I also have an author's amendment.
All right. So thank you, Chair Hornstein. So you have the A40 amendment?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Please move it and explain it.
So, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to move the H1683A40 amendment. And this amendment does three things. Number one, it fixes some engrossing errors in the appropriation amounts. Secondly, it creates a new reintegration driver's license. This is a new type of limited license for individuals being released whose license had been suspended, canceled, revoked, or denied due to a violation that occurred prior to their incarceration. And this is House File 4571 from Representative Pinto. This was heard in our committee. We had this originally in our bill in the walkthrough, but we pulled it back because we didn't have a fiscal note. And I don't like to move finance bills out of our committee without the fiscal note. We have received that fiscal note. It has gone through several revisions over the break. We now have it in a form where I believe it accomplishes the need to fund this program. There is no general fund impact. So that is the second part of this amendment. And then finally, we make some technical corrections to the ignition interlock language that has been previously passed. So that is the author's amendment.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions on the amendment? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just asking because I'm on public safety and we didn't hear this portion about incarcerated folks getting licenses back. And help me understand it, Chair Hornstein. Is this, have they been reinstated or is this in addition? I don't quite understand what you're doing because if their license has been suspended, revoked, all of those sorts of things, but now you're giving them a license back, what is the license able to do or is it a full reinstatement?
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what you're doing.
Thank you. So thank you for the question, Madam Chair. I feel that, so a couple things. Number one, and we have some experts here that can answer that question. I was hoping we would have Representative Pinto because it's his legislation, but I'll do my best. my understanding here is that there this only lasts for a year. There are some accountability measures when one receives this license. It's important for a couple of reasons. Number one, for folks to reintegrate, it's transportation is a critical part of this, and so they would be able to, you know, move around as anyone else would. And then also an ID, you know, for employment, for housing. One of the reasons I support this so strongly is I think that reintegration lessens the successful reintegration lessens the rate of recidivism, and it's a very good public safety measure. And I'm glad that you brought public safety to this, because we did check with we had some interest in making sure that both the public safety chair and even judiciary were, you know, saw this as a transportation issue, not so much a public safety direct issue, and we were able to keep it in our committee based on those conversations. But to your question, we do have Ms. Odegaard here, if that would be helpful. You could probably get some more specifics.
And Representative O'Neill, we do have Representative Pinto, who can also.
Oh, he's online.
Yes,
I didn't see him present here. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative O'Neill may have had her question adequately answered. I think Chair Hornstein did a terrific job with that. But if she has further questions about the proposal, we're happy to answer them. I'll just note that, yes, this really is a transportation provision. It's just that it has wonderful spillovers in terms of public safety and community safety. These are people who are no longer in custody, they're no longer in prison. What they are is out in our community, and the issue is, do they get a driver's license or not? And that's an issue that is a transportation issue. But again, happy to discuss it further.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'm still confused. So there's a whole process to be reinstated with DVS, and I'm just asking, is this superseding that normal process to be reinstated with your driver's license, or certain parameters that you have to meet? And or is this just a streamlined, quick, here's your ID? Now, I understand the whole issue of the ID. Had it been only an ID, which we talk about in public safety quite a lot, that's one thing. But if this is reinstating their driving privileges, that is yet a completely different thing, which I would have a problem with, and I couldn't support the amendment. So, I mean, I don't understand it. Are we just superseding all of the parameters that are in place already to get reinstated, or is this following the normal procedures to get reinstated?
Do we have anyone in the audience who can respond to Representative? Please come up. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Could you please introduce yourself and proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition, and I've been working in partnership with a number of other organizations to support this legislation. And I would love to respond to Representative O'Neill's question.
Please.
Representative O'Neill, we modeled this on the limited license program that's already existing in statute. It's Chapter 17130 that allows individuals with exclusions for particularly serious dangerous driving violations. So excluding those folks from eligibility, it allows certain folks who are suspended or revoked to access a limited license for the purpose of getting to work or to treatment or et cetera. What we recognize is that folks coming out of incarceration likely would not qualify for that limited license, because often they have to have a job and housing in order to specify where they will be driving to and from. And the issue with folks coming out of incarceration is that their whole project often is to reestablish stable housing, find employment, and then, of course, meet all the other requirements of their supervision, which may be treatment or et cetera. So we modeled this. The eligibility matches up exactly with the limited license program in terms of, so just for instance, if someone's license is canceled as an immigrant to public safety, they're not eligible for this program. If their license is suspended related to a child support payment issue, they're also not eligible until they resolve that issue. And then there are several criminal vehicle operation statutes, and if their violations were related to criminal vehicular operation, they're not eligible for this. So this is mostly people who have unpaid fines and fees from prior to being incarcerated. Sometimes there are folks who, they actually come out of incarceration, they pay the fines and fees for prior traffic tickets, and as a result of those payments, they are suspended as a habitual violator, but those are for violations that maybe happened several years ago prior to incarceration. They might be insurance-related violations, or folks who would be able to be reinstated but for being able to pay the reinstatement fee. So folks in those categories would be eligible for this reintegration license for 1 year, and it's kind of a one chance and you're out. So if they commit any additional violations that would lead to a suspension or revocation of a license, then their reintegration license would be canceled and you can't apply for it a second time. But it is kind of a one chance, 1 year license for folks who don't fall into those more serious driving categories, but who really need that license to meet the requirements of their supervision and don't have the payment, the financial resources to get that license.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the indulgence. Just one last quick question, just about the fee. So the fee is also waived then, the reinstatement fee?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ms. Odegaard.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, if in the case where somebody holds onto their reintegration license for a full year, there's no fee up front. When we were very specific about that, because of course that's a barrier for a lot of folks. There's no fee up front to get the reintegration license. If they're able to hang onto that license for a full year, they're not reincarcerated and they don't commit any additional violations, then they're eligible to apply for their full driving privileges to be reinstated. They do need to pay the applicable license fees for a new driver's license, but they would not need to pay any old reinstatement fees. They would just need to pay the new fees that I think we all pay when we renew our license.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Moran, Representative Hornstein, I have a lot of concerns with this bill or this amendment, this portion of it. I'm reading through it, and I read through it last night, and cross-reference all the statutes in it. And I found out that if you have your license revoked or suspended for some of the offenses that are included in this, you spend 180 days in the county jail, you get your license back. But a person that doesn't might have to wait a year to get their license back. This should be vetted a lot better in the Public Safety Committee. And I'm going to make a motion right now that this goes to Public Safety because there is a huge public safety issue on this.
Ms. Odegaard, would you like to respond?
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Johnson.
Ms. Odegaard wanted to respond, if that's okay.
No, yes. Okay. I gave her permission. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. We did align the waiting periods. So there are waiting periods in the limited license provisions in 170.130. But for instance, for criminal vehicular operations, there are additional waiting periods, some of them up to, I think they're 6 years, 8 years, 10 years. And we were very clear in the legislation that if someone had a violation that was related to criminal vehicular operation, they would need to have fulfilled that entire waiting period before they could be eligible for this reintegration license.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pinto, would you also like to chime in on Representative Johnson's concerns?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. I'll just note that, you know, this is a situation where someone has been put in custody for something that they have that they've done. We are holding them accountable. And then when they get out, the question is fundamentally a question within the Transportation Committee's jurisdiction, which is that do they have access to this limited license that is parallel to the limited license that currently exists under transportation statutes? And are we going to give them this kind of provisional time where they can demonstrate that they are trustworthy, that it can all work, and that at the end they can have a regular license that they pay a full fee for? But let's remember that when somebody gets out, we want them to be integrated in our society, we want them to be working, et cetera. But again, these fundamentally are fundamentally transportation questions within the jurisdiction of that committee. Of course, there are public safety spillovers, as there are in all sorts of things that we do. But I would argue against, and having checked in with Chair Mariani, that there'd be a need for this to be decision to be made within the Public Safety Committee, because this is fundamentally an issue of driver's licenses, which is a transportation issue. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Pinto. I have Representative Liebling. Would you like to speak to this?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just would like to speak to it on the procedural grounds. You know, I don't think it's in order to make a motion to move an amendment to another committee. If there's a motion on a bill, that's one thing. But you can't make a motion and move amendments from one committee to another. If you don't like the amendment, your remedy is to vote no on it. So Madam Chair, I just wanted to speak up to urge you to just rule the motion out of order. We're debating the amendment, and we should vote on the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I appreciate that information. And just finally, let's see if we can get Chair Mariani to speak on this.
Morning, Chair members. I do think that Representative Liebling, Chair Liebling, is correct. That would be my procedural advice at this point. I assume if the amendment were to go on, then Representative Johnson can redirect the motion of the future path of the bill, I suppose. But I do want to add, I think Representative Pinto really characterized correctly how we thought through and distinguished appropriate jurisdiction for this issue. I am convinced that this is a jurisdictional issue for how we administer our driver's licenses. I do believe that the bill, the language before us in the bill, is actually pretty tightly constructed. I think it's pretty smartly constructed so as to not create any kind of conflict with the appropriate penalties, what individuals do to our society by virtue of having committed a wrong. That's taken care of, by their having met their sentence. And so there's no, crossover in terms of mitigating that criminal punishment. And so what we're left with then really is an administrative decision that's under the purview of the Transportation Committee in this legislature, by virtue of being under the purview of the Department of Motor Vehicle Services. So I'm sorry for belaboring it, but I just to emphasize the point that as chair of the Public Safety Committee, I see no compelling reason for us to entertain this language if there is a subsequent motion to move the bill back to or over to Public Safety.
So I want to thank everyone for their advice. I'm going to rule Representative Johnson motion out of order, and we will move forward and we will vote on the amendment as is and have it attached to the current bill. Representative Johnson.
Doing some checking, I understand that once this amendment is added, then to re-refer it, the bill is in order, so I will we'll probably be doing that at that time. But again, I have concerns. Last year, we, for ID purposes in the Public Safety Committee, we changed the policy because of the number of individuals in the Department of Corrections custody needed an ID. So we provided their prison ID to be used for identification purposes until they could get obtained by application a state ID card or a driver's license should they pursue that. Now we're giving it to them without cost. Going through this, while a person that wants to get a limited license has to pay fees, in this bill, for reintegrated driver's license, the commissioner cannot impose the fees. This is absolutely ridiculous. You're treating those that are incarcerated better than the citizens who follow the laws.
Representative O'Neill, would you like to speak to the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I should have just finished my thought after I heard the explanation of this bill, essentially, as an amendment. I actually don't have a problem with this. I've worked on this type of legislation before. I've worked with Ms. Odegaard before. I just wanted to be clear what we were doing, and once she cleared up exactly what it was and what it was patterned after and where the reinstatement fees come in, I don't actually have a problem with this at all. I should have just finished that thought after she described everything. So I just wanted to make that very clear, because I have worked in this area of law a bit before. So I have an understanding of this, and I don't have a problem with this addition. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for that clarity. So seeing no further questions on the A40 amendment that is before us, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So no other amendments were pre-filed. House File 1683, as amended, is before us. Are there any other questions for the author or nonpartisan staff or general comments to the bill itself? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Representative Hornstein, and feel free to defer to staff. On the bottom of page 54, the top of page 55, this is Article 3, Section 44. This is related to including suicide as an eligible or a qualifying condition for a death benefit. I'm familiar with this bill because Representative Hansen, unfortunately, is not here, is the chief author of House File 4627. It looks like it's the same objective, but the language is somewhat different. Do you have a resource, either Representative Hansen or nonpartisan staff, who can kind of compare it to that that version of the bill?
Chair Hornstein.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, yes, I would want to defer, but just for the benefit of the committee, this relates to benefits related to PTSD as it relates to officers in the State Patrol. So, yes, maybe if there is some expertise that could answer Representative Garofalo's question. I don't know if it would be Mr. Burris or anyone else who would have.
I think we have Mr. Burge, who's available to speak on it. Okay. Oh, he's
Madam
lovely.
Chair, members
Mr. Burge.
Of the committee. Yes. Matt Burris with House Research. Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, yes, I haven't done a careful comparison recently of the difference, but there were some technical changes that were intended to address some grammatical and conceptual issues that led to a difference in this compared to what had been introduced in the governor's supplemental budget for transportation. I've got a outstanding question to the department about whether this achieves their underlying policy goals that they had originally proposed with this. So there might still be an open question. I believe the intent matches up with the bill that Representative Hansen is carrying, but obviously there is a language difference.
Okay.
If you don't mind, you want to go to Representative Hansen? Okay. Let's go to Representative Hansen. Let's get some clarity here. Representative Hansen.
I think this is Hansen J rather than Hansen R.
Oh, okay.
Is it mine?
So it's not Rick. Okay, sorry, Chair.
No.
Okay, this is Madam Chair.
Yes. Yes, Chair Hansen.
This is a benefit. Hold on just a minute.
While we're waiting for Representative Hansen,
okay.
I just have a question for Mr. Burris, if you still have it. Mr. Burris, is this language prospective only, or does it cover previous cases?
Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the language is silent on the timing of when deaths would occur. So I'd have to give that a little bit of thought of how far back.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, just so I can fill in the committee on this. So this is language that I worked on. It's something that's a priority to me. So I actually took the link because majority party usually carries, you have a better chance of success if the majority party carries it. So I had asked a member of the DFL to carry it. I think this is Representative Hansen, and I believe Representative Moeller has a bill that's similar. That's the origins of this. And so, so Chairman Hornstein, the difficulty is that at one point, whatever point you draw the line here, there will be people that are covered by this, families who lost lost a family member, and those who are not covered by it. I want to raise that issue with you about when this is effective, because it would have a dramatic impact on people who've lost a loved one. And I just want to work with you on that to make sure that we can get that in there. So I don't want to delay the proceedings, but that was that's the dialogue around this language. And I apologize. I did not catch that this language was in there until we were in committee, so I would have brought it up with you. So.
Chair Holstein.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. Madam Chair. Oh, we have a Representative Hanson. But I will say on the record, I'm happy to work with you on that.
Thanks, Mayor.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Chair Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for the confusion because there were two bills that were put in, one authored by myself, and Representative Garofalo is correct. This deals with a South St. Paul officer who was lost through suicide and lives in, I believe, Representative Garofalo's district. And Representative Moeller also had put in the bill, and that was one that I thought had been moving. And so I would just back up Representative Garofalo's statements and comments about this tragic situation that we're trying to provide a remedy for.
Thank you, Chair Hanson. So what I hear is that Representative Garofalo will work with Chair Hornstein to clean up this language, to get it to a place that is agreeable. All right, is there any? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I'd like to just say thank you to Chair Hornstein for allowing me to work with him this year. This has been a great opportunity, and we've communicated very well. I do see in this bill, though, that there are two glaring errors that are, in my opinion, are something that we should have really have dealt with. First of all is what the surplus that we've had this year. This was the time to be able to invest more dollars into our transportation system, and that would have been through the auto parts sales tax. And Mr. Chair, you actually passed the bill out of our committee and put it in taxes. It's not in the tax bill, and it's not in this bill. And in my opinion, that's a mistake. That's something in which we should have got those funds in. But Mr. Chair, I also know that the limits of what kind of quote moving target that you had didn't allow it for it as well, but I think that's something that we need to all reconsider later down the date, the way, if we can increase those moving targets, because I think that's something that really ought to be done, and it gives an opportunity to give a shot in the arm to transportation into the future as well, because those are ongoing revenues, and they're going to be increasing revenues as sales tax increases as well. The other issue, and Mr. Chair, you can comment on that later, but the other issue is you and I co-authored a bill really looking for kind of what we would consider as more of the mismanagement of Met Council in regards to the Southwest Light Rail, and I think that was appropriate, and it indicates to me at least that Met Council has some a great degree of concern, or at least I have concern, with how they are managing projects. And yet your project, your bill here has quite a few more bus rapid transit programs and others that I think may be more advantageous if we were to wait to find out what the legislative auditor had to say in regards to management and control of bidding and so forth. You know, and I know there's going to be people that are saying, well, if we don't do it now, we're just going to lose a year or two. But, you know, over the years, I've learned that when high-pressure salesmen try to say, you've only got today to make that decision, tomorrow will be too late, usually you ought to wait. And so I'm concerned that we are putting forth projects and funding some of them that in which we may have unintended consequences into the future. And if it means that we have to wait even just part of a year or so, I think that would be better until we get the legislative audit report to see if there are other issues that need to be corrected before we go ahead with it. So those are two main glaring mistakes, I think. There are a lot of good things in this bill, Mr. Chair, but I think there are some that we really are missing the boat here on this particular bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Seeing no further, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just thank you, Representative Hornstein. Chair Hornstein, I just have a quick question about the fee increases. You've got a $3 fee increase on Class D licenses and then an $8 for Real ID. And I'm just curious, because we have a huge budget surplus, obviously, and where are those fees going to go? What is that for? And what does it generate, I guess, is the biggest question.
Chair Holmstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill. I appreciate the question. So last year, there were a number of bills that were addressing some of the issues that, in particular, deputy registrars around the state were facing in terms of additional workloads and shortfalls, of course, because of COVID and a variety of issues. And these have been around our committee for many years. Rather than sort of kind of sift through those issues last year, in the conference committee, Chairman Newman and I decided to seek the advice of Mr. Rick King, who had been very helpful in our transition from MNLARS to our new driver registration system. So we charged him with doing a report to address a number of the issues related to driver vehicle services. And so this, these particular recommendations come out of that bipartisan report, or bipartisan directed report, and these provisions line up with what's happening in the Senate bill. And so, you know, a variety of different options we had, and so I chose for sort of a modest fee increase for those purposes, and that will really assist our deputy registrars.
Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair. And how much does it generate?
Mr. Lee already knew that I was going to be asking him, so he's going to be
he's very good
answering that question. Madam Chair.
Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, Andrew Lee from House Fiscal Staff, and Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, the estimated increase in those fee changes are on the spreadsheet on line 223 on page 4. That would be an increase to the driver services special revenue fund account of approximately $511,000 a year. That's the amount of fee increase that would is estimated to accrue on if transactions go through the state system. But if the transaction occurs through the driver's agent, then the driver's agent would retain that fee increase.
Representative Neal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was the next thing I was going to ask is, when do the deputy registrars actually get the fee? So if they transact it, then they keep it. If they don't transact it, they don't keep any of it. Does any of it that goes to the state then come back to the deputy registrars too, or is it just only when they transact?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, under the proposal in the independent expert review article of the bill, there is a provision that would have a percentage of online and mail transactions. The, a portion of that fee revenue would then go to the deputy registrars. That it doesn't exist in current law, but if this were to be enacted, then there would be that mechanism where a portion of mail and online transactions would go to the deputy registrars.
Representative O'Neill.
Okay, good. Because our, you know, our deputy registrars have been, as you just said, just going out of business, literally, all across the state because they are private entities. So, okay, so that's how you're dealing with that. And the last question I have, and I'll let this go, but I couldn't let this go without a couple quick concerns. Here we are again. I was on your committee a long time ago, Chair Hornstein, and way back then, 10 years ago, we were talking about light rail to Duluth. And, you know, in the committee, we talked about how it was just college students that were going to take the train because we kept saying, well, who's going to ride the train from Duluth to the Twin Cities? Who's actually going to ride it? And back then, that's all they could come up with was maybe college students going back to college. So that's of concern. But then you couple that with only $4 million for township roads. I mean, think about how many township roads there are in the entire state of Minnesota, and we're giving them $4 million. So we're going to put in light rail up to Duluth that no one's going to ride, and we've got just such a small amount of money for township roads. And maybe I'll just ask this question since we have experts up here. How many miles of township roads do we have, and basically how much is that per mile?
Chair Hornstein or Mr. Lee?
Madam Chair, I don't have that that data at my fingertips, but we certainly could provide it to the committee and to Representative O'Neill. I know, Representative Garofalo, you should know that.
Yeah, right.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure it's pennies. I'm sure it's pennies per mile because it's just so little. But I just thought that was a really interesting. And then there's no money for the corridors of commerce, which, of course, you and I worked on, again, 10 years ago. That was very successful. So we have no money for corridors of commerce. We have this light rail train to Duluth that no one's going to ride. And we have $4 million for all of those township roads, which is literally pennies per mile. So this is an interesting bill, let's just say. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Chair Moran, Representative Hornstein, I was just going through the bill to get some more, and I just spotted a couple different things that I'd like you to explain, if you could. There's funding for a pilot project on 64.18, Section 58. Speed safety camera pilot project. Can you explain what that is, and what's the purpose of that?
Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Johnson. Yes, as I mentioned in my opening comments, one of the themes of our committee was safety. Safety for drivers, safety for pedestrians, safety for all road users. We actually had a week's worth of hearing. We heard from law enforcement. We heard from citizens. We heard from public officials. We heard from safety groups. And it became very clear that this demanded action. And so the Department of Public Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services came to us with a proposal based on some of the concerns that were raised at this week's worth of hearings, two entire hearings devoted to this. And they came to us with, I thought, a very good proposal to enhance the Towards Zero Deaths program by creating a task force that would be really looking at ways in which we, through public education, through other mechanisms, begin to address the 502 deaths on our roads. And again, we have the pandemic of COVID, but we have the epidemic of traffic deaths. And we've had, Representative Johnson, one of the success stories is that our distracted driving legislation that we've had over the years, the texting ban, the hands-free, that is an area in which deaths and injuries have gone down. But speeding in particular, but also impaired driving, those have gone up. We've had a number of pedestrian deaths and fatalities. So we are really looking at this as a way to address safety. And there's other ways we address safety in the bill, but specifically that's how this came about. Representative Johnson.
Representative Johnson.
All right, Chair Moran, Representative Hornsey. I understand this. We had traffic cameras in the past that were ruled unconstitutional because of the way our laws are written. I'm just wondering if this is just to have a study, try to figure out how it can be done within our current statutes that are in the Constitution.
Yes. Madam Chair, you're referring to the work zone safety provision in this bill, and we are not prescribing any specific strategy on that. We're just asking DPS and MnDOT to report back to us in a year what their implementation plan would be. Again, the work zone safety issue is another one, another sub-theme of our safety theme in this bill. We have had, again, a number of construction workers, officers, others that have been killed or injured specifically in work zones. So cameras may be an option, but we are not prescribing that specifically in this bill.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Moran, Chair Hornstein, thank you for that information. It's unfortunate that we are short so many law enforcement officers across the state. the attacks on law enforcement has caused a huge shortage. We had many of them retire, which affected the pension bill. Many of them resigned. Last I heard, we're short between 1,000 and 1,500 officers across the state. We also have, because of the attacks on law enforcement, we have officers that are no longer doing proactive law enforcement. It's just response, responding to the call. On my travels down here from Cambridge, it's regularly I have vehicles go by me at well over 100 miles an hour. And I rarely see a state patrol, any county, any city squad cars, because the attacks that have gone on law enforcement. Until we get that straightened out, I don't care what you do, nothing's going to happen because people don't care. The speed that people are driving at and the way they're driving is out of control. When I'm down here driving around St. Paul, I see cars regularly going through red lights, stop signs, pedestrians having to jump out of the way because we don't have any law enforcement officers to provide traffic control. They're responding to the other calls. I didn't think I'd have an opportunity to talk about public safety on a transportation bill, but your bill is pointing out the problems with what's going on because of the attack on law enforcement. It's a great profession. They're out there doing their job to protect people. I'm going to get off that one now. And another concern I have is Section 59. It is a plan to implement a mileage tax. For those of you who live in the metro area and drive the transit or use transit, it doesn't affect you. But in the greatest part of Minnesota, greater Minnesota, it's huge. Many people have 20-minute drive just one way to go to the grocery store. That's not counting the drive to work. The drive to go pick up your kids at school events because they no longer have buses or activity buses to bring the kids home. Driving 20 miles, actually, I have one person in my area, they had to drive 33 miles one way to go vote on a school bond referendum. Mileage tax is interesting when you don't have to drive. But for those that have to drive because of where they live, it's huge. I'm really concerned that they're even talking about a mileage tax. So, like I say, with what's in this bill, there's no way I can support it.
Did you want to respond, Chair Hornstein?
Well, there's several responses to several comments. If people have additional ones, we can get those out on the table. Otherwise, I could respond to what's been said already.
All right, thank you. So seeing no further discussion, Chair Hornstein, do you have any closing comments?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the discussion and of course, the interest in transportation that everybody shares on both sides of the aisle. Let me just respond to a couple of comments, and then I'll make a very brief closing statement. To Representative Petersburg's concerns, he pointed out correctly that one of the ways we're addressing some of the issues with Southwest is light rail is through perhaps one of the most extensive legislative audits we've ever had in the state. Thanks to the legislature and the bipartisan interest in this, we have 17 different areas that we have asked the legislative auditor to examine. That bill was passed, and through our established legislative audit process, all of you, again, I believe on a bipartisan basis, have asked for this audit through the process that's been set up through our own legislative audit. So I'm looking forward to those results. And I would just say, Representative Petersburg and members, that you know, what we have in this bill related to transit is simply giving the Met Council some resources to study some additional arterial bus rapid transit lines. We don't have funding specifically for those lines, but this has been a very, very successful, flexible, cost-effective transit solution that has been supported by both sides of the aisle. And so we're simply asking for that to be studied further, some additional lines around the metro area. The other transit provisions in this bill are simply enhancements. We have some money for additional shelters and other ways in which we can enhance local bus service in the suburban area. For example, there's a very successful project that allows sort of a Lyft Uber service for, you know, the last miles. This is something that Minnesota Valley Transit and Southwest Transit have pioneered. So these are the kinds of transit enhancements we have in this legislation. And so, you know, that is, you know, important for the region. And I, again, I think that, as you correctly point out, Representative Petersburg, we do have a governance issue with the Met Council. That's why I've once again introduced a bill to elect the Met Council. And I hope we can advance that. I think there's some other ideas around perhaps a council of governments. You know, I think that Representative Nash, Representative Albright have all worked on and thought about this over the years. I hope we can come together. Maybe there's still some things we can do this session on that. But I have introduced House File 1122 to elect the Met Council. So I hope we can do that. If there is an issue, you've correctly identified that governance issue. To Representative O'Neill, I know what you're getting at in terms of the issue with the Northern Lights Express. I disagree with you on the ridership, but I do want to just clarify on the record, you had mentioned that it's a light rail project. It is actually considered passenger rail, and passenger rail is very different than commuter rail, different than North Star, different than Southwest, than the Green Line and the Blue Line. So it's passenger rail. There will be a lot of enhancements to the freight corridor as well that we'll be paying for, and a significant change over past. You mentioned we've been talking about this for 10 years. There's a very, very significant change now, which is that Amtrak will be taking this on, and that cost has actually gone down because of that. And so we're matching federal money. As for townships, I would like to fund townships more. However, they do receive some support from our existing transportation funding through the Highway User Trust Distribution Fund. Small cities do not, and so therefore we have a position for small cities that is significant in this bill and ongoing. And we're continuing to search for ways in which we can have ongoing dedicated funding for small cities. So I appreciate you raising that, and I wanted to clarify that. In terms of the Corridors of Commerce program, we have a really significant policy enhancement in this bill that's been championed by Representative Torkelson. And I appreciate his work on this. The Corridors of Commerce program is successful but needs to be updated. So we have significant policy initiative in that is bipartisan in nature, different from what the Senate has. So we'll have to see what we come up with. But we have a really important provision around corridors in this bill. And we did have bonding for it last year. And then finally, related to your concern, Representative Johnson, about the task force that we've set up on the mileage fee, I want to be clear, this only relates to electric vehicles. In the past, resisted efforts. The Senate has imposed huge fees on electric vehicle owners. I believe we should be incenting electric vehicles. We do have a position for electric vehicle infrastructure and electric buses in this bill, really important for the climate crisis that we're going through. But we wanted to come to the conference committee with at least an idea, which is to have a task force to study if a mileage-based fee makes sense for electric vehicles. This is an initiative from Representative Elkins. So rather than just sort of prima facie saying no on this, we at least want to at least study the idea for a mileage-based fee for electric vehicles only. And so that's what this is. I wanted to clarify this is not a sweeping mileage fee, although, Representative Johnson, I do personally believe in the long term, with the gas tax revenue going down, we will need some other mechanism to fund roads and bridges. A mileage-based fee is one of them. However, that is not in this bill. This is simply a study group to look at a mileage-based fee for electric vehicles only. So, members, with that, I just wanted to thank you for your consideration and reiterate that this bill is comprehensive. It covers all parts of the state. It covers all modes of transportation. We have important safety enhancements. We address mobility. We address the economic development potential that transportation has. With transportation being the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions, we address the climate crisis. Transportation also needs to be looked at through an equity lens. We continue what we did on that work last year, really looking at the equity issues, particularly with our transit and pedestrian safety provisions in this bill. So it's a great bill. I ask for your support, and I thank you for your consideration.
All right. Well, thank you, Chair Hornstein, for your committee's work in support of a multimodal transportation system that meets the needs of Minnesotans across the state, as well as addressing the problems with the DVS functions. With that, the chair would temporarily lay House File 1683 as amended over. Thank you. So our next bill is House File 4324, which is a supplemental Veterans and Military Affairs omnibus. Chair Eklund.
Morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Would you like to move House File 4323 to get it before the committee?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
So would you like to move your office amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to present it?
I'll move, Madam Chair, the A5 amendment.
Okay, could you please explain your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment is largely technical. As in one of the bills yesterday, there was lines with dot, dot, dot. We changed those to zeros on line 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, 1.5, page 7, line 15, delete 4. That was to cover the project in, I believe it was Washington County, the Veterans Park project. It said 4 septic systems. There's actually 8, so we just deleted the number in there so they'd all be covered. And 1.6, page 7, line 17, and the insert lines, this is a one-time appropriation. That's the amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Are there any questions to the amendment? If not, the A5 author's amendment is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Since there's no other amendments that were pre-filed, House File 4324 as amended is before us. Chair Eklund, please continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 4324 is a result of the session's work on veterans and military affairs issues. It addresses in a substantive way two crucial interconnected issues for veterans, for our state's veterans, veterans homelessness, and veterans suicide. Through this bill, we are investing over $10 million to end veterans homelessness in Minnesota. This includes an all hands-on-deck approach, providing temporary supportive housing to deal with influx of veterans experiencing homelessness, building permanent housing so that veterans experiencing homeless now and in the future have a place to go where their needs will be met, and coordinating landlord and tenancy support services to keep veterans at risk for homelessness in their housing options. This measure will bring us closer to zero veterans experiencing homelessness in the state and provide model measures to make us a leader in the nation. Furthermore, Madam Chair, this bill invests heavily in supportive resolutions to bring us closer to ending veteran suicide. Through early interventions and education, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs will work with stakeholders across the state to reduce this number and scale up their existing efforts. Other provisions in the bill, bonus pay for post 9/11 veterans, approximately $25 million for bonus pays for veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars and the Gold Star families. It provides a $7 million for enlistment and re-enlistment bonuses for the Minnesota National Guard to ensure the Guard stays ready for service. Madam Chair, members, our National Guard has done yeoman's work this past 2 years through the pandemic, and we need to provide resources for them so that we can get our Guard members to re-enlist. Invest nearly $1 million in Meals and Wheels support to specifically include veterans in the programs. MDVA is excited about this provision, Madam Chair, because they figure it's one more way to provide outreach to the veterans and provide feedback if they are in danger of homelessness or suicide or those type of things. It increases county veteran services officer grants and increasing grants to veteran service organizations to support the activities of these services for veterans. That is collectively $1.8 million. Provides operating expenses for the new Redwood Falls State Veterans Cemetery, provides funding to build the Fisher House near Fargo VA Medical Center to serve Minnesota veterans and their families as they receive care. There's a grant to the Minnesota Navy League for activities around the commissioning of the USS Minneapolis-St. Paul. And it finally, Madam Chair, members, it provides for an implementation of holistic health and fitness program for the Minnesota National Guard to align best practices with the federal armed forces and increase readiness for our National Guard members. Madam Chair, there are members, individuals from the Guard and from MDVA, and I believe Ms. Roberts is also in line if there's any questions on the spreadsheet.
That is great. Are there any questions for the author? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Eklund, thanks for putting together a good bill. One question for you on line 18 of the spreadsheet. We see the service bonus to Minnesota post 9/11 veterans. Governor recommended $40 million, yet your bill is at $24.8 million, about a 15% reduction to that. Can you just talk to us about why you did that?
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo. When we looked at doing that, we compared it to past bonus programs. The most recent one was the Persian Gulf bonus program. And approximately 60% of the people that had the bonuses coming applied. So we purposely kept this at, I think it's at about 62.3 or something like that. It's where the percentage is out. I'm not much of a numbers person when it comes to that. But we purposely kept it above the 60%. So we would just try to encompass what happened in past bonus programs.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative
Eklund, structurally, what is the differences between the House program and the governor's program?
Chair Eklund.
Representative Garofalo, I didn't catch that. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Eklund, so the governor's proposal was for $40 million, and ours, and the House, ours, yours, the House proposal is at $24.8 million, so there's that's a reduction there. Why is it smaller? Why is it, if the program's the same, why is the dollar amount less?
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think I tried to explain that. Representative Garofalo, is the past time about 60% of the veterans actually applied for the bonus. So we are going on that same number from past practice.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but Representative Eklund, so there's no change in eligibility. It's just it's the assumption of what the take rate is going to be?
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Eklund, thank you first for incorporating the amendment that Representative Detmer had brought to our attention. Thanks for putting that in there. And then wanted to thank you for the assistance to help the commissioning of the USS Minneapolis-St. Paul. For those that are not familiar with that, it's LCS 21. It is a fantastic ship that is going into naval service that is named after our two largest cities in our state. It's a tremendous honor, and it will be held in a certain somebody's district, but it's going to be commissioned in Duluth, and all legislators are invited to go. As the father of a kid in the Navy, this is a tremendous thing to have happen in our state and for our state. So I wanted to thank you for the bill, and thanks for the work.
All right. Any closing comments?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members. And, you know, 4 years ago when I took was given the privilege of chairing the Veterans Committee, I made it my goal to address veterans homelessness and veteran suicide. So I think if you take a look at this bill, we're gonna go a long ways in the state of Minnesota to accomplish that goal and lead the nation in these type of programs. So I'm really proud of this bill, and I ask for support, Madam Chair.
Well, I just want to thank you, Chair Eklund, for bringing a really, really good board, a good bill for to support our veterans. There's a lot of good stuff in this bill. And I also want to thank your committee efforts on a critical, important work of ending veterans' homelessness and preventing suicide and other provision that you included in this bill. With that, the Chair will temporarily lay House File 4324 as amended over. So our next bills is House File 4306, the Omnibus Pension Bill. I want to welcome our mighty committee chair, Chair Murphy, to the Ways and Means Committee. Welcome, Chair Murphy.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 4306, I didn't think of as the omnibus pension bill in the sense that it was an independent bill brought, but I convinced all the members of the LCPR to the Democratic members to join me as the authors.
All right, thank you. So, Vice Chair Olson, would you like to move House File 4306 to get the bill before the committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So I understand there's also a couple of author's amendments you'd like to have offered to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to present it. Vice Chair Olson, would you like to move the H4306DE3 amendment on behalf of the author?
Madam Chair, I move the DE3.
Okay.
And Madam Chair and Representative Olson, there's a technical amendment, the A2 amendment, that makes two clarifications in the DE3.
So, Chair Olson, would you like to move the A2 amendment to the DE3?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the A2 amendment, which is the amendment to the DE3.
All right. So, Chair Murphy, please explain the amendment to the amendment.
Madam Chair, I really want, before I explain all that, I would like to thank the people in Nonpartisan House Research and fiscal analysts Helen Roberts and Patrick McCormick, and Matt Gehring, and the LCPR legislative staff, Susan Lancheski, and Chad Burkett, and Lisa Dieslin, for all their help, especially Wednesday and Thursday of last week, and Monday and Tuesday of this week, and they caught the errors that were in the changing DE1 and DE2 that you've never seen. And so we come to the DE3, which is basically downsizing of the original 4306. Which was a billion-dollar bill.
Okay.
That we need a change in the system. We need a way in the financial system running the state of Minnesota and cities and counties and public employees that work in every single part of the state, that are members of the public employee pension funds, and all the people that serve the people of Minnesota and are the connecting people in every part of our state need to be represented at the financial table in a much better way than they ever have. We have the LCPR, which is the solution of bringing all those people and the state pension plans, the 9 state pension plans, together and solve all their problems. Mm. But we do not have a budget, a way of gathering finances for increasing the budgets at all, anywhere, as a line item. Not in the governor's budgets, not in the state agency's budgets. And I thought a few years back in this century, when I was chair of state government finance, that that was going to be the answer. But I was not able, as that chair, to make that decision. We only have ways of getting new money into the pension funds from the state treasury by having a crisis and a bill to solve it. Or we could have recommendations from the governors, Democratic governors, Republican governors, every governor could make the change and say, we are going to take so much money, when they're predicting what kind of money they have in the forecasts and all that, and say, this is the amount we're going to dedicate to the pensions of the people of Minnesota. But we don't have that mechanism. And so I go in pension commission in this century and 2 or 3 years of the last century and make my rants about like this, bringing to the attention that at some times we need new money. We have a wonderful state board of investment with very talented directors in the past. And lately, really talented director, 2 really talented directors the last few years. And we were getting wonderful returns on our investment decisions. And that's what's kept things going. But when we have a crisis, then we have to always beg for funding from Treasury to this. In the last few years, I've been working with the agency directors of MMD and REBIN, trying to convince them to become part of the governor's budget processes. But we have not been successful. But I did make a comment on a regular basis. And I thought I was going to get it in for when Governor Walz became governor. But the person I thought was going to get it in changed jobs. And so that fell through too. And so here I am with House File 4306. And I thought, this is the year then. We'll get the governor's attention. We'll get the people's attention. We'll get the representatives' attention. We'll get the Senate attention. We'll offer a billion-dollar bill. And we'll have to talk about how money gets into the pension funds. But I've made comments, and I made my rants, and I made my calls. And in the supplemental budget, the governor, Governor Walz, had a one-time appropriation to raise COLAs for the people that are members of the public employee, the former public employees that are members of the pension funds. $73 million. Not a billion, but $73 million. And I had the bill, 4306. And I thought, well, I can amend the bill. And I can get a target. And I can work with what the Pension Commission has been doing from January to now, this year. And we can make some accommodations. Because the governor was becoming involved, and the finances were becoming involved. But I don't have a fiscal note on this because in 4306, I left a blank on the assumption rates that the plans directors really were talking about for the last January, February, March of this year. And I didn't know if we were going to decide to go from 7.5 to 7% or not. And so I left a blank for that. And so when we asked for a fiscal note, we couldn't get it because they don't do blanks. So I had to make a decision, and yes, and we went to 7. Not my personal choice, but the choice that made the most political sense in the fact that the directors had a lot more ammunition for their 7% than that I had for 7.5. And so that's that part DE3 is, it says 7. And we put in for a fiscal note, and because of the holiday, it did not, it hasn't come through yet, but it will before you're finished.
Okay.
And the plan directors won on that article, but there is direct state aid in here for the plans. And there was a time in the teens of this century when communication wasn't so great. And in 2016, the governor vetoed pension, the bill that passed out of the Pension Commission. And the years 15, 16, 17 weren't such good years for everybody. And there was a little bit of shortchanging to 3 plans that I mentioned in Article 1. And this bill will correct that shortchanging. and the rest is just a one-time, two-time cost of living, not just, is a cost of living increases for the retirees that are in the pension plans, the 9 pension plans, all of them.
Right. Well,
and
you.
So I ask for your support. I ask for your understanding. And I ask for you allow this to go forward, and there will be probably a DE4 at some point in time, but or whatever happens to it. But it is time that we all get people to think about the promises that are made when we tell people when they first take a job and they're put in to our pension funds. We can't be Big Brother without new money from Big Sister coming along on a regular basis. Every single time the budget is considered, we should be considering the promises that are made to the workers when we hire them and tell them what a good place the state of Minnesota is, or what good county employee you would make, or what good city or township officer and employee you would make. And we can't desert people after they've retired and they get to live wherever in Minnesota they want, or wherever they want. But they're in every one of our districts, those past employees, and that their pensions deserve to be considered on a yearly basis or bi-yearly basis for the permanency. It's wonderful to receive. There were years when I, as a teacher, received thank you letters from people 102 years old or 103 years old that got a 13th check, because that was a little bonus, and they were able to help the grandchildren or great-grandchildren with their college tuition, or just giving them a graduation present. Our pension decisions affect every family, every person, from birth to death in Minnesota. We connect with those people, and we can't lose sight of them as people.
And let's not lose sight of them, Chair Murphy. I just want to thank you for your thoughtful, informational, passionate insight into the pensions and this bill that you have brought before us. Just want to thank you for that. Well, so for the members, we have the A2 amendment to the DE3 before us. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment to the amendment is adopted. We also, I heard Chair Murphy go through the DE3, which is also before us. All those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Nay. The motion prevails, and the amendment, as amended, is adopted. Members, do you have any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Murphy, you caught my attention, not just by the red blouse you're wearing. We talked about that on the way over, but also by your very eloquent words about pensions. We served together for a number of years on the pension committee. And I think...
You remember the rant.
It's not the first time. But I also remember serving with you in 2018 when we quite literally changed the direction of the pensions to get them back to a fully funded state over a number of years. And that didn't come without compromise, and it didn't come without our appreciation for how we needed to get that work done. And it was not a light lift, if you will. So when we bring this forward, and I know I'm not going to get into the technicalities because I know that you're going to be presenting this before the pension committee next week, if that's my correct understanding. My only question, or maybe two, Representative Murphy, is how does this align with any endeavors, efforts in the Senate? And I'm not trying to compare, but is there alignment for this initiative coming before the pension committee with the rest of the members?
Jim Murphy.
Madam Chair, this has a companion in the Senate. Senator Frentz, who is also on the Pension Commission, is the chief author, and he has other authors. And I don't know that, but we have, I don't know any more beyond that at this time, because it pretty much happened in the last weekend.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Murphy, one technical question, and it just goes to, I know it in the bill that you are increasing the COLA, but at the same time, you're reducing the expected rate of return. So on the one hand, there's more outflow, but a target of less earnings. In consideration of what we accomplished in 2018, to work towards fully funding of our pension plans, would it be fair to say that your bill enhances or distracts from the work that we had in 2018?
Jim Murphy.
Madam Chair, I think it enhances because we're moving forward and we are addressing the immediate need of telling our the recipients that the state of Minnesota cares about what's happening to them today. And it pays for the change that we're making today. But it doesn't promise that that's going to happen again. That's up to the new legislature in the next financial budget year. And it's up to the governor and the LCPR, which will be new people in the next year.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson. Chair Nelson, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, and this is more of a comment. We've in the Pension Commission this year, we've heard a lot about the assumed rate of return, and all the funds have endorsed lowering that rate of return. Now, that doesn't change anything that's going in to the fund. It's just looking out in the future as far as the funding status of the plans that by assuming a 7.5% return, if we don't get that, we actually fall short. By lowering it to 7%, and we earlier, a couple years ago, part of, I think, the 2018, we lowered the assumed rate of return from 8.5% to 7.5%. It just basically, it's a more realistic look at what we're going to return on the funds. The advisors, the actuaries, are all saying that 7.5% is too high. We're in the higher end of pension plans around the country with that. By lowering the rate of return, It doesn't change anything going in there. It doesn't change how the returns are. We're just going to assume that we're not going to make that 7.5%. It'd be like me going buying a lottery ticket and winning $1,000 on the lottery ticket and assuming I'm going to do that every week. That's not going to happen. And then basing my spending on that, having that extra grand in my pocket every week. So by doing this, we're basically taking a more realistic look at the returns the funds are going to do. And this last year, we had some really good returns. But in the past years, we've had lower returns. And consistently, the State Board of Investment has done a good job of beating, even at the 8.5, the rate of returns that we're having. It's just that we want to be more realistic going in the future, that looking at how the returns are going to come in, and so that if we don't get that 7.5, or we don't get the 7%, we are actually not having to dip in and put more money into these funds out of the general fund, and hopefully they can self-sustain that way.
Thank you for that clarity. Seeing any other questions? Seeing none. Okay, good. Chair Murphy, do you have any closing comments?
I don't. Okay. Madam Chair, I don't know. There's people that have been working with pensions for a long time in the audience. I don't know if anyone came to testify or not. But I really appreciate your consideration, and I appreciate the opportunity that the speaker has given the retirees and present employees of Minnesota for having a target.
Well, thank you, Chair Murphy. So what we're going to do, the chair will temporarily lay House File 4306 as amended over. Thank you, Chair Murphy.
Thank you very much.
So you're up next, Chair Nelson. Bringing forth House File 4293, which is the Supplemental State Government Finance and Election Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll move 4293 to be referred to the General Register.
All right, so I have, so we also have an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to present it. I will move the H4293 A17 amendment. Can you please explain it?
And Madam Chair, members, this amendment, as was in the Veterans Committee amendment or bill, the amendment is to delete the dot, dot, dots and insert zeros in those. That's a technical amendment. And then it deals with the Indigenous Peoples Day and changing Christopher Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. It was meant to put that in originally, and we missed it going through. So that's what this amendment does.
Any questions on the amendment? If not, the author's A17 amendment is before us. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Nelson, please continue with your presentation, and then we'll take up the other amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Get my notes here and get them in line. Members, this is the state government budget, a supplemental budget bill. The target we had, or the overbase that we have of this bill, is just under $77 million. But members, the majority of that, $49 million of that, has to do with IT and cybersecurity. In the legislature portion of the bill, there's $14 million going to the revisor's office for the updating their systems that they use for presenting or creating our bills and our amendments. They're falling out of date on that, and so that's the biggest amount of appropriation there. There's also money in the legislature part of the bill dealing with raises for our staff. We've been having trouble hiring staff. We've been having trouble hanging on to staff. And this is just a small piece to try and enhance the jobs here so that we get our people to stay. If we go down here, again, the IT part of it in a minute, there's a $12 million over the 2 years for enterprise cloud transformation, again, updating our IT systems. There's $10 million in there for executive branch technology and modernizations, and there's $10 million for advanced cybersecurity tools. And then there's, if you go back on the next, on the IT theme, Minnesota Managed Budget, there's the, what they call the ERP systems. There's a $7 million to update those. And what the ERP systems are, members, is that's the backbone, that's the SWIFT, that's the, all those systems that run in the background that the Minnesota Management and Budget uses to pay our bills, and all the different departments use that. So that's what those are, is to update those and get them up to date so that currently we're at a point where some of the updates can't be done because we're not fully up to date on those bills. Again, like I said, there's $16.9 million to the legislature. The largest chunk is that upgrade of the information technology systems for the revisor's office. There's a $2.3 million adjustment for the AG. There's money here, $310,000 to the Secretary of State. Some of that is money going for a chief information officer to deal with, again, their IT and one person in charge of that. There's also money in here to match HAVA funds that are coming from the federal government. There are state matching funds for that. I already spoke about the minute. The majority of that, again, is updating systems and cybersecurity. And with that, members, and there's also some money in here for the Historical Society for part of that for reopening the places that were closed down during COVID. Some of those are one-time costs to get those buildings, those sites up and running so that the public can visit them. And with that, members, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions. We have people here to help answer questions that, and if I can't answer them, I'll call on them.
All right. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as the minority lead on this committee, I appreciated working with the chair. We have a good working relationship. We don't always agree on things, and the things that we do agree on, we work closely together. Members, many of the provisions in here are things that I've authored in the past, so it's awfully hard to rain on their parade, but we do have a need to take cybersecurity more seriously in the state of Minnesota. And I would like to eventually work to the point where we make funding programmatic instead of going back and forth into the well. Working in the world and advocating for cybersecurity in my job, it is a fixed cost that should be built into the conduction of business. So I would like to eventually get to the point where we can do that. But there are some other things that I think caused me some concerns, more from the policy perspective, and certainly we'll talk about the spending provisions, and I made a promise that I'll only beat it up a little bit here in committee, and we'll beat it up more on the floor. But I think that some of the elections issues that we've talked about, and we've had a long-standing conversation around the need to have elections provisions be bipartisan, and when one of the parties has a disagreement, that we would remove them based on a long-standing agreement going back to many governors to make sure that any elections changes are indeed, for lack of a better term, benign. Well, we don't have that in this. And I find that deeply disappointing that now for the last two biennia, we have had elections provisions that come into bills that we move through the system that are opposed by the minority party, and yet we move them forward. And I came here hoping and seeing that was the previous expectation, but we've sailed away from that. And I don't know that, Mr. Chair, that that's necessarily your desire. I think that those are directions that you've been given from leadership, and I find that deeply troubling. I think that Minnesotans look at us here, and Minnesotans expect of us to seek what is best in the eyes of the people that they have sent to St. Paul to represent them. And that if we have things that are controversial, that we would remove them and let them go as a standalone bill. And that was always my understanding. And Mr. Chair, when I first came in the majority and you were the minority lead on the committee, that was how we did it. I find that very troubling. And so should you. So should you. If the provisions that you have included in this bill that have opposition by our party are so fantastic, put them on the floor. steel your spine enough to say, we're going to run this as a solo bill and do it, instead of layering it into an omnibus bill and trying to make it have a little extra protection as it flies through things. One of the other things that I have, some might use the word harped on, but I will say worked on passionately since my arrival here at the Capitol, is the idea that it takes a lot of money and a percentage of money to administer grants. So in the provision here, Mr. Chair, if you could maybe help us once we get to the point where I have a question, you've got a variable amount that can be used for the administration of grants, could be 5%, could be 10% of a grant to administer a grant. Let's walk through that. Let's say we have a grant that is for $1 million, and you're going to allow 10% peel off to administer that grant. That's $100,000 to the administration to basically take a bucket of money from here and move it over to here. Let's say that person is responsible for doing 4 or 5 over the course of the year. You're saying that they're going to peel off $500,000, maybe $1 million in administration of grants. I would say that if we're looking at an FTE to do that, I would hope that they could do more than one grant administration in the course of their yearly job. But what is this money going for? I've asked and asked and asked and asked, and no one's ever actually had a legitimate answer to say, well, here are the things, Representative Nash, that go into administering a grant. Now, if you look at the not-for-profit world, and they get grants all the time, they do not require 10% to administer a grant. And you've heard me say this quote before, this is effectively, the bureaucracy is expanding to meet the needs of the expanding bureaucracy. So you've got a policy provision in here, Mr. Chair, that allows us to hire, well, you, allows the administration to hire more bureaucrats to push paper around so that you can hire more bureaucrats. When you should be saying grant money, if this is a viable, legitimate need by the grant recipient, why wouldn't you want to put as much money in their hands as possible instead of funding through your largesse another pile of bureaucrats? So I'm mystified by that. And Mr. Chair, can you help me understand how the 10% variable was achieved that? Because again, in a $1 million grant, that's $100,000 for a person. I'm still trying to figure that one out.
Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure which section you're talking about. Again, it's a lot of bills put together here. So I don't know how to answer that. All I know is that we've had some issues this last year with grants that came out, and some of that was from the federal government that were passed through. But that administration of those grants, there was some fraud that was dealt with that in that. And so I think some of that is what takes up as part of the grant administration as to, I think the language is up to, not 10%, but up to that amount. And I don't think the administration has in the past, and I could be wrong there, but has in the past has gone up to the 10%, but that's the language that was requested by the administration in the bill.
Is there someone in the audience who has a response? Well, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Could you please introduce yourself and respond.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Julie Byrell. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Administration. We want to thank Representative Nelson for including this. This was our request. This has really come from enterprise grant makers who have expressed this need to us in the past. Admin houses the Office of Grants Management. This request is for 5% for holdback for grant administration when the grants are legislatively named, on up to 10% when it's a competitive grant program. So when it's a competitive grant program, the grant administrator is required to do determine who needs the grant, and also doing extensive review of the grant. So you're doing upfront assistance to potential grantees. You are assisting the grantees through the process and requesting information and oversight to make sure that the taxpayer funds are protected and that the grantees are getting good customer service from the state employees.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, and Ms. Byrle, we can maybe take this offline, but you're saying that a person is administering this competitive grant possibly, and they may take, because the language is permissive, it may take up to 10%. Well, is that person only working on one grant per year? Because if we're trying to effectively make this a pass-through so we don't incur extra cost to administer this grant, you're saying that on a $1 million grant, that person is effectively accounting for $100,000. I would hope that the state of Minnesota was better at administering grants than this, because 10% peel off when we've got the Office of Justice or the Department of Justice for their grants takes 2.5%. And on other things, you're saying, well, we only need 5%. Having served in capacities as a board member in not-for-profits for many years, you can do it much more lean than this. So once again, I will remind you of my quote that the bureaucracy is expanding to meet the needs of the expanding bureaucracy. If we are simply hiring more and more and more people to push paper and administer grants, God help us. So what you're effectively saying is that the people of the state of Minnesota who are being taxed to create the money to go into these grants are now also paying for another person to be hired to administer that grant. I'm baffled. I certainly understand that it does take effort to administer grants. I do. But up to 10%, because it is permissive, you could take up to 10%, is mind-boggling. And we will be talking about that on the floor. We'll rest assured that that's going to happen. So with that, I am done on that particular piece. But once again, I want to point out that the elections provisions in here are not purely bipartisan. And we've talked about that, Mr. Chair. And I will honestly say, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, I believe that that pains you, that you would prefer that in this supplemental budget bill, also over the request for elections bill, that there should be things in there that are completely and utterly benign. And I think you have been pushed over an edge, that cliff that you would not otherwise choose to go on your own. We will be talking about that as well on the floor. But this is the problem, and I think we talked about it yesterday. This is the trouble and the problem that we have with omnibus bills. We just decide to, it's a Christmas tree bill. We just throw everything on a branch and hope that everyone thinks it's pretty. It's not. And I would encourage you to consider taking some of the amendments that we're going to offer, peeling those things out and dealing with it on your own, on its own. If it has merit and your members are willing to put up votes for it, vote for it. Do it. You got the votes. If you think that some of these election provisions are so fantastic, then put them up on the floor on their own. This is a troublesome bill. I don't think that a lot of it's going to become law. And as a result of that, I don't feel like I need to belabor the point, which I'm sure you're happy about, Mr. Chair. But understand that there are some deeply troubling things in here, and there are some very good things in here. There really are. Things that on their own I would support. But when you lump them in with all this other stuff, it makes it unbelievably hard to pallet. So with that, once this becomes engrossed, I would encourage all members to vote against it, because it's just not a particularly well thought out bill. And that's not demeaning you, but you've been forced to put in things that are just crap. So with that, I'll be done. Thank you.
Okay, so we have one other amendment that was pre-filed. Chair Becca Finn, you have the 820 amendment. Please move it and tell us about it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would move that amendment. It just removes a couple lines on page 108 of the bill regarding the way that we're notifying folks about what's an absentee ballot and what's a sample ballot. It just simplifies things to make it a little bit easier, a little bit less of the all caps text. So that would be my amendment and would appreciate the support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, is there any comments from the Representative Nash?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that was thank you. That was my bill when we put it in committee. And you know, if you type anything online, you know that all caps is effectively yelling. I think if you are like me and many of our colleagues that received troubled calls from people all during the last election, they were screaming in the phone. They're like, "They're sending me real ballots. How dare they?" Well, this bill, and I think that the chair agrees with me, is an effort to say this is not a live ballot. This is not an actual thing that's being sent to you by the government. And when I walk out to the mailbox, I'm sorting stuff that's going to go into the recycling bin before I even walk inside. So something that's in all caps, if it can gain your attention a little bit more, I think that that's a worthy effort. For those of you who receive those calls, I see you smiling at me and nodding your heads. This is not a bad way to go, because I think that the people who are getting these requests from valid entities that want to say, we'd like you to do an absentee ballot request and we're providing that for you, they should step up to the plate and they should say, this is not an actual ballot. This is not something that's being sent to you that's a real thing that you're going to mail in and cast your vote. So I think that the cap letters are just fine, because it's there to try to gain your attention. So I would encourage members to vote no on the amendment, because we're trying to gain people's attention. And if you're a little bit crass like me and you're already sorting mail out to go into the recycling bin before you walk inside the house, this may just be the step that we need. Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments to the A20 amendment?
Madam Chair. Sorry, when I saw this, I did not realize. I thought we were inserting this language into the bill. I didn't realize we're actually deleting it. What's the rationale for deleting this language from the bill?
Chair Becker Fan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for clarifying that, Representative Garofalo. This is not removing the language. There is currently in the bill, there is a lengthier version of the language. So this would just take out that lengthier version and really get to the point, which is to the point of you're still going to see on the thing in the mail, this is an absentee ballot application, not an official ballot, or this is a sample ballot, not an official ballot. So the language is still there. It's just a trimmed down, more get to the point version of the language.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, seeing no further discussion to the 820 that is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, I'm sorry. Representative Scott, you had a question to the 820 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a question to the bill, so I'll wait for comments on the bill.
All right, thank you. Okay, so why don't we open it up to you right now, Representative Scott.
Very well. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the bill's author, I'm just wondering what the additional $2.335 million to the Office of the Attorney General is for.
Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott, for the question. The $2.335 million for the Attorney General's office is for operating adjustment and, again, as part of the legislative, I talked about operating adjustment to hang on to staff. That's for the same thing in the Attorney General's office, operating adjustment so they can hang on to their good staff they have there and continue to do the work they need to do. They're having issues with people leaving because they're being underpaid, as opposed to some of our counties are stealing the staff. Stealing may be a bit tough word, but they're enticing the staff at the Attorney General's office to leave the AG's office and go to work for our counties or go work elsewhere. And this is just an attempt to try and hang on to some of that staff.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Could you break this down a little bit more? I mean, how many employees do they have? I mean, $2.3 million seems like an awful lot of money for enhanced salaries or benefits or whatever they're going to be doing to entice these people. Could you break that down a little bit more, Mr. Chair?
Madam Chair and Representative Scott, I think we have somebody here from on Zoom from the AG's office, Ms. Talken-Holtz.
Okay, Ms. Talken-Holtz, can you respond to Representative Scott's question in more detail?
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Laura Talken-Holtz. I'm the Legislative Director for the Office of the Attorney General. Thank you, Representative Scott. So I would need to get the exact breakdown, and I can get those numbers to you. But it is about retention of our talented staff who are paid less than area public attorney offices. And it's also to help with some of the administrative functions such as finance and information technology and really the backbone of the office.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And it's good to see you, Laura. Question, did these needs exist last year during our budget year?
Mrs. Talken-Holtz.
These have been sort of ongoing needs. As you may know, the office has experienced some historical disinvestment. Our budget in real dollars is approximately what it was about 20 years ago. And so this has been an ongoing accumulation. In terms of last year, I would need to certainly go back and check. We did have in our last year's request, our request for the criminal supplemental expand our criminal division to help local county attorneys when they request assistance.
And Madam Chair.
Chair Nelson.
And Madam Chair, yes, that this amount was in the budget we proposed last year. It wasn't agreed to by the Senate. So it was in our budget request last year.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what the funds and the way they'll be dispersed, is it a lump sum or is there an hourly rate that the AG receives? How does that work?
Ms. Talken-Holtz.
Most of the employees on staff are by salary, and so it would be a salary increase.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do you have an idea of the – well, first of all, could you tell me how many employees there are? And will this be going to all employees, whether that's they're doing, you know, the actual – if they're lawyers or if they're other staff? Is everybody getting a raise, just the lawyers? And how many employees do you have and what's the breakdown of that?
We have approximately 135 attorneys, and I would need to go back and double check on the other staff. In terms of how the pay would be, it's about competitive retention compensation. So are you looking for specific details about who and how much, and is this across the board, that sort of thing? Okay, let me go back and check on that, and I can get that to you.
Sorry for the dog barking. Thank you. And Madam Chair, would it be possible that if Ms. Talken-Holtz gets that information prior to our adjournment for the day, that she could share that with the committee?
Mrs. Talken-Holtz, can you try to get that information to us before we end this committee hearing today? And if not, we would definitely appreciate getting it as soon as possible.
I will do my best. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing no further discussion, Chair Nelson, would you do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, this is the bill. Total bill, we're a little over $77 million over base in the bill. or a little under $77 million, but a majority of that, $49 million of it, is for IT and cybersecurity, which we all know is what's some of the stuff that's going on now. That's something we need to constantly we need to invest in, and so that's what this is going for. And so I ask for your support.
Well, thank you, Chair Nelson, for your committee's continued work on the state technology and cybersecurity, making our elections more secure, and the multiple equity provisions to reflect our increasingly diverse state. So there being no further discussion, we will proceed to the motion to combine the four bills and send them to the floor using House File 4293 as the vehicle.
Can I leave here, or are you on me?
Chair Nelson.
Do I need, can I go back there, or do we? Do you need me here?
Stay right there.
Okay. That's why I'm asking.
Okay, Chair Nelson would like to move that the language contained in House File 4293 as amended be incorporated into the State Government, Veterans and Military Affairs, Pension and Transportation Omnibus as a separate article. Would you like to move that?
That's my motion, Madam Chair.
So the Nelson motion is before us, and unless someone requests a roll call, we're going to do a voice vote. So those all in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposing nay.
No.
No.
The motion prevails. Next, we have Chair Hornstein, who would like to move that the language contained in House File 1683 as amended be incorporated into State Government, Veterans and Military Affairs, Pension and Transportation Omnibus as a separate article.
So moved, Madam Chair.
So the Hornstein motion is before us. This vote is just to add the transportation language as a separate article to the omnibus bill. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. Chair Eklund would like to move that the language contained in House File 4324 as amended be incorporated into State Government, Veterans and Military Affairs, Pension and Transportation Omnibus as a separate article.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
So the Eklund motion is before us. This is just on the motion to include the Veterans and Military Affairs language as separate articles in the omnibus bill. Does everyone understand the motion?
As amended, Madam Chair.
As amended. Thank you. So Chair, Vice Chair Olson, would you like to move that the pension language contained in House File 4293?
Do we need to vote on that?
Do we need to vote? All those in favor, so for clarity, the Eklund motion is before us, and it is the motion is to include the Veterans in a Military Affairs language as a separate article as amended. All those in favor to the motion say aye.
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 Aye. No.
The motion prevails. Now, Vice Chair Olson, would you like to move that the pension language contained in House File 4306 as amended be incorporated into State Government, Veterans and Military Affairs, Pension and Transportation as separate articles?
So moved, Madam Chair.
So the Olson motion is before us. So we're just voting to insert the pension language into the omnibus. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
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 All opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. So House File 4293 as amended is before the body, is before us. The next vote would be the final vote on the combined package. Chair Nelson renews his original motion that House File 4293 as amended be recommended for placement on a general register, and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make any technical corrections and amend the title. This will be a roll call. Ms. Anna, please take the roll.
Chair Moran.
Aye.
Moran, aye. Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo.
Garofalo, no.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright.
Albright, no.
Albright, no. Representative Becker-Finn. Representative Bernardi.
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Hanson, aye. Representative Hassan?
Hassan, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, no.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Kresha?
Kresha, no.
Kresha, no. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
No.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg?
No.
Petersburg, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. And Representative Becker Finn?
Becker Finn, aye.
Becker Finn, aye. So, Madam Chair, that is 18 ayes and 11 nays.
So there have been 18 ayes and 11 nays. The motion prevails, and House File 4293, as amended, is recommended for placement on the General Register, and nonpartisan staff is directed to are directed to make any technical corrections and amend the title. I want to thank you, a big thanks to all the chairs in your committee for putting together this important work. And so before, let me see, this does complete our work today, but before we adjourn, I'm going to pass it over to Representative Miller.
Madam Chair, thank you, and I'll be brief. I just, as we listened today, at some point yesterday after Representative Groffler gave his message about the need to simplify these bills, not combine them, it was said, I believe by you, perhaps some other people, that this was, I think I heard words, I didn't write them down, but words like necessary because it's more efficient, or because of the time we have, or because of these different things. And also, as Representative Groffler said, this is not a DFL thing. When we were in the majority, we saw these sorts of mm-hmm. things too. But I walked away yesterday feeling like I got my answer, but I didn't get my answer. Mm. So I guess I asked you, Madam Chair, as specifically as you can, why are we building these gigantic bills and saying, well, we have to do this or we're not going to get anything done this year? That's what I hear. So you can rephrase that. But I don't think people back home can understand why these bills, there's some similarities to these, mm-hmm. but by and large, they aren't. They just seem to be all piled into one single thing. Can you help me understand why we're doing this? Yeah.
Here, Representative Miller, you know, we have some tough decisions to make here. You know, this is really not our preference neither. What we are doing is because we have to align our bills with the Senate. This is the purpose and the reason that we're doing it this way, is to align our work so that we are not putting more work in on our staff who has to align the language that we are doing. So for that purpose, we are aligning with the Republican Senate.
Okay, so Madam Chair, yes. At the risk of upsetting my Republican Senate friends, if I understand you're saying that the Republican Senates are demanding that we combine these mega bills, and so you have no choice in that matter, is that what I'm hearing?
Representative Miller, what I'm saying is that we found that it's easier to avoid the process that we're working through in working in relationship with the Republican Senate, that we are aligning the bills. Some bills, you know, because of in the Senate, there may be bills that's moving off the floor a little bit later than what we're doing. And so it just makes it more easier and more efficient, not just for us as Democrats, but for our staff, that we're overtaxing and overworking through this process.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a final comment I don't think I'm alone in saying this, that when I was elected, the people that voted for me didn't ask me to make it easier and quicker. I think they asked us to do our work. And as Representative Groffler said yesterday, I won't be here. He didn't say this, but I won't be here next year. But I certainly hope this changes, because I've heard it from both sides of the aisle. The leadership likes it this way. Some chairs like this a little bit. I've heard chairs that don't.
but I can tell you the people that are what we refer to as rank and file members, I've never heard any of them like this process. So just for the record, we've got to change this. This is not okay. We are going to be spending billions upon billions of dollars, and we're doing it under the guise of this needs to be more efficient and quick so we can get it done and get out of here. So that's my comment. I'll stop from there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I think we have another, before we adjourn, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I also had wanted to comment on this when it was discussed before. So if you'll just indulge me for a moment on this. You know, as a longtime member, I have also seen more of a tendency toward this concentration, although I have to say, even from the very beginning of my legislative career, there were always complaints about leadership at the end of session making decisions in a room with the governor. This is not a new phenomenon. It's still a troubling phenomenon, but not a new one. So, I think that Representative Miller is talking about something that is real and is troubling to all members. However, it's easy to criticize the process we have, and we don't really have a better one right now. Now, I do want to say that over the years, I've seen, as has been mentioned, both parties doing this mega omnibus bill thing, and some years it's been far worse than this. But I want us to look at ourselves, too, because part of the reason that this becomes that leadership, I believe, views this as necessary is because often what we see on the House floor is flat-out obstructionism. And we could, in theory, be passing separate omnibus bills and have different debates on each one. But where some members see it as their job to obstruct the business of the House and not just bring out points in a bill, not just debate the bill, not just explain why they're going to vote no on a bill, but stop the House from actually getting its business done. And when leadership knows that members are going to do that, and maybe it's a chicken and egg thing, maybe that comes from the concentration of these bills, I don't know. But what we see is attempts to filibuster bills and just go on and on. And what I would say is sometimes abusive kinds of debate, if you can even call it debate, on the House floor. And, you know, if these big bills are necessary, I would argue it's necessary, kind of in quotes, because of that conduct. So if you're going to have 12 hours of debate on a bill, at least at the end, you're getting through with a big, big package. So I think members need to look at their own conduct and see, and this is on both sides of the aisle, when we're in the minority, to see if we're using those kinds of tactics. The other thing I just wanted to say briefly, I think it was Representative Petersburg said yesterday that there were not enough Republicans on conference committees. And I just wanted to point out it used to be the rule, maybe it was an unwritten rule, that you had to vote for a bill to get on a conference committee. I actually think the House leadership is extremely generous right now with the minority party, because it seems to me that we get a Republican on every conference committee, whether they vote for the bill or not. And most of the time, they're not voting for it. So again, I don't think they do that in the Senate. My understanding is if you want to be on a conference committee, you got to be voting for the bill. And if you're in the minority and you want to be on there, you better be voting for the bill. So we're not enforcing that in the House. I frankly wish we would, because I don't think that somebody who didn't vote for a bill can really be there to uphold the House position. So thank you, Madam Chair, for letting me make those comments. And on the fundamental issue, I think that it is true. It would be better to have individual bills. I wish we could do that. Thank you.
Thank you for that history and that reminder of why we are where we are today. So, ma'am, I just want to remind you that tomorrow we would take up the early childhood and education finance bills. For all your paperwork, please put anything that you'd like to save back into your committee folder. Anything that is left on the table will be recycled. And with that, we are adjourned.